goes out of their bodies. The baby they brought home together now, a young man, feet fumbling out of the rubble. Witness a child die and quickly descend into a realm of demons. Witness your child die, and you become the demon, hurled to the earth, manacled everlasting to who you are after. They came in violently. Every Sunday is bloody. Every mouth is a house of prayer. They came in violently. Every hand is a God who heals or hurts, heals and hurts. 29 foreheads kneeled to worship the ground and never rose again.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Life, Art, Being, Integrative Arts Festival, taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. The Life, Art, Being Integrative Arts Festival will include workshops, panel discussions, and performances about somatic, expressive, deep ecology, and community building, creative, and ecological practices. Again, that's the Life, Art, Being Integrative Arts Festival taking place July 28th to August 5th at various locations around Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is always looking for ways people can work with us and support us. KBOO has a wish list, and we'd love help getting some of those items donated. Some things on our list include a color printer, digital recorders, a pop-up canopy, dishwashing detergent, brooms and mops, or services like roofing, plumbing, and electrical work. Please contact station co-manager Delphine at del@kboo.org or go to kboo.fm/kboo's wishlist. For more information about supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:02, coming up on Pacific Underground. I speak with labor movement, or the labor movement, with organizer Deepay Wu. Thank you, KBOO members, for all of your generous support. And for those who've not yet become members in the KBOO Foundation, well, no time like the present, and no present like the time it takes you to go to kboo.fm/give. That said, here is more of what you're supporting. Your community radio.
Underground. This is the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders talk about issues that affect us deeply. We're your hosts for this week. I'm Kanan.
And I'm Jenna.
And today we're going to be talking about labor. And one person in labor in particular sat down with organizer Deepay Wu, formerly head of Jobs with Justice, the Portland chapter. And they are up to some different stuff now, but I kind of wanted to ask them about their journey through the labor movement and what brought them into labor organizing as a queer identifying person of color, first generation Chinese American. They have a lot of different identifiers. They have done an incredible amount of work in their lifetime, and
what they do is amazing.
Yeah, well, they're an inspiration.
So one of the reasons we wanted to talk to Dee was because here at Pacific Underground, we were really interested in looking into the idea of sustainable activism. You've heard us talk about it before in previous episodes with activists like Scott Nakagawa, and we're constantly asking this question. Especially since this year's elections, we've seen a lot of people want to get involved, and people got really kind of like political and got into the streets for the first couple months, and then we've seen this really kind of die off, where people either maybe don't know how to stay involved in activism over a long period of time, or maybe people lose hope. And so we just wanted to sort of look into that and say, well, what are people doing that have been doing this for a long time? What motivates them? What inspires them? And what continues having them doing the work? So this is kind of our attempt at interviewing lots of people who have different perspectives and who have been doing the work for a long time.
My name's Dee Pei Wu. I was the executive director of Portland Jobs with Justice for 2 years. I've been in Portland, I think, 5 years. I grew up in New York and spent 15 years working in the Bay Area and LA and some other places. And this is like probably like my 7th different career in my life. I was born in New York City. My parents are Chinese.
How did you come to working in labor?
It's a long, funny, convoluted, twisted journey. Well, first of all, Tiananmen Square in 1989 was really a catapulting point for me. You know, in school, I remember this very clearly. I think there was like 2 paragraphs, if we're lucky, about the civil rights movement, and you know, 1 or 2 paragraphs about the 60s in general.
Like in the textbooks?
Yeah, in our history textbooks in high school. I went to public school, right? In southwestern Connecticut, so better than a lot of other public school systems in the city, in the country, but still public school, and it was fun, and you know, but it was also the limitations of the education system are made very clear in those kinds of situations. So, and none of those, right, either the civil rights movement or the sort of dominant narrative around the 60s, none of those shows people like me, right, or my parents or anyone that I knew growing up in my community,
right,
doing any kind of political work. And so Tiananmen Square was the first time that happened. Also, you know, my parents are medium to conservative, you know, they kind of, and now they're retired, and so they just want to live their life. Mm-hmm. But back in the day when that was happening, we were glued to the television like all day, every day for like the 3 weeks, you know, or however long that lasted. And that was a really big deal. And so it was family time, but it was also that this kind of movement was absolutely possible by people who looked like me, but also even people who weren't that political, you know, could be galvanized by something like that. That sort of like sparks your imagination, right? I was in high school and we made posters, and then this print shop gave me like a discount on 2-color printing. Right, all these people had been sort of excited by what was happening. They'd heard about what was happening. They weren't necessarily doing anything extra, but then that print shop, you know, donating an extra color screen, you know, all of that was really meaningful to a high school kid who didn't know anything about t-shirt printing or whatever, right? And so we raised a couple $1,000 to send, you know, to part of the relief funds that helped got activists out of China, either into Hong Kong or the Canada or the UK for the most part. So that was like the beginning. That was a long time ago.
Were these your classmates that you were working with and raising money with? And
so I like to tell people this story about my parents. My parents, like I said, are not super political, but they were always organizers. And what they organized in was the Chinese community, right? They knew that they were in the U.S. They were concerned that their children would grow up without knowing who they were. These are their words. And so it was really important for them to be involved in the Chinese Association where I came from. And so they were, my mom was the principal of the Chinese school for a long time. My dad was like president of the board. And so they were organizing in the community. There was always people in our house. And so that sense of community building is actually really central to how I've understood what organizing and activism and community building and movement building are, right? Is that people belong, people are welcomed, people are fed, people are taken care of. that we're teaching and learning together, you know, yeah. and that we have a responsibility to each other and to a larger community, you know, also that you can fade in and out of the work, right? You do the work for as long as you're there, but you don't have to hold on to it. It's not a power struggle when there's new leaders coming along and it's time for you to move on because of whatever, then it's time. Right. All my parents showed me all of those things through the work that they did with the Chinese Association of Fairfield County. And again, as much as our politics don't necessarily align, there's a very deeply like human element and a very deeply community centered element to that. And that I think I really does travel through all of my organizing.
Those ideas are so important for organizing, but I think those are some of the ones that are actually missing when it comes down to the organizing that happens here. When we don't necessarily have the option to learn organizing from our parents at a very young age. Because I think most of the people that I personally organize with, you know, don't have that background. They came into organizing maybe after going to college mm-hmm. or maybe like in high school or something. But mm-hmm. those ideas of, you know, knowing when to step back, of like bringing people in and having that integration into family and like personal life, mm-hmm. those are things that are like high in the sky at least like for me. That's really amazing and incredible to hear that like that was something that was going on, and you know, it wasn't even necessarily like radical political community organizing. It was just making things happen in the community.
Yeah, you know, I also challenge us to like really, especially for folks of color, right? Like to reach back into our own communities, whatever our ethnic identities are. Because even white people have these deep held community values that are actually very radical when it comes down to it. If we, you know, look at like the way that capitalism needs us to be in order to support it, right? Then our community values, it doesn't matter what tradition you come from, there are these community values of taking care of each other, and I don't want to be totally like Pollyannish and naive about it, you know, because now I'm like listening to myself and I'm like, oh my God, but there, you know, and this is not perfect, right? My parents were like, also could be whatever, right? Everybody in that community could be petty, but you know, I, as a kid, I was protected from that. I didn't see that. What I experienced was like, people took care of each other. People took care of each other's kids, whether you liked it or not. And, you know, and nobody was like attacking each other at dinner, at those big, you know, gala dinners, Lunar New Year dinner or whatever it was. You were just living, and we were kids. And so we were part of the dance troops, the performance troops. And so there was also this thing where like you worked really hard to like do things well, right? Whether that was like the dance performance or the martial arts performance or the decorations on the wall or the food that people sold at the, you know, at the Oyster Festival and stuff like that. So we were also involved in the wider community. And that was really good, you know? I think it also made me not afraid to sort of be up on stage and afraid of things like that. Mm. I still don't, it's not my favorite thing, but you know how to do it, right? So right. You just do it because it's the thing you gotta do. So that started it. I've been involved in environmental work for a while. When I was in college, I was like in the vegan co-op and stuff like that. And it was as much an economic decision. This is where this like, you know, class, race, and ideology thing can really come together. I wasn't just in it because like I believed in veganism, right? Like there are different cultural ways around vegetarianism. And so it's actually easy in the food that we make, you know, that my family makes, to be vegetarian. It's, you know, and also like, this is something that I think most people in the West don't really realize. I'm like, a lot of our dishes have tofu and meat in them. So what? You know, it's just like, it's really good. What are you talking about? You got soft and you got chewy and you got spicy. And anyway, so like, yeah, I could talk about food for hours. And so like the idea of vegetarianism being a certain way and the certain kinds of foods that you have to eat if you're like the radical vegan vegetarian, you know, that wasn't as relevant to me. But a couple of my friends were super into like, let's try new food. It economically makes a lot of sense. And also, again, it is community building. Some of the students that I met through that are still my friends. None of us are vegetarian anymore, actually. But, you know, we're also very conscious about sort of what we consume and how often. So vegetarian co-op but then I did environmental work, right? So I was an environmental researcher. And so this is interesting because when you're in labor, you know, people are talking about the construction trades and how hard work that is. It is, right? It's very intense physical labor. Mm-hmm. It's also very intense mental labor to be so focused, sort of pick a fight if they need to. And that is really interesting to me, right? There's some emotional intelligence there that is not often ascribed to that class and sector of working people. Right? These folks are actually some of like the most grounded people because they're like, I ain't got no extra energy to spare. I'm only going to worry about the things that actually matter.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And it's that's like a survival instinct that's like pragmatic because you don't, if you're spending energy getting into trouble, how are you going to make ends meet?
Yeah. And these are good people, you know? But I think about that because when I was doing scientific research, it wasn't lab research, it was field research. And so I was carrying 50 pounds of gear up and down a mountain, easily hiking 10 miles a day in different parts of the world, you know, and 5 to 7 days a week. So it's good, hard labor. I learned how to climb trees, throw ropes, other things that are sort of high skilled. And that also gives me a lot of appreciation, right, for physical labor. I also really love it, you know, but also it's a very gendered thing, right? Like folks expect someone who, you know, was female at the time to have had that experience. And so I've certainly had the experience of guys like being like, oh yeah, I get that. But other guys will be like, oh, well, that's just not the same. I'm like, what's not the same about knowing how to throw a line over a tree and set it up and climb, you know, and be up 100+ feet in the air? Like, yeah, I know how to do that, right? What's not this 50 pounds? It's 50 pounds of gear up and down a damn mountain, whatever gender you are or identify as, right?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that. It depends on who you're talking about. You know, other folks just get it and they're like, yeah, well, you know, it's cool. They get it. And then they're like, oh yeah. So you understand, right?
What kind of research were you doing?
It was biological fieldwork. So way back in the day, it was mostly animal behavior and like tree research. So really looking at, and this is interesting. At least to me, it is sort of, you know, there's a real way that we're focused on individuals in the US and we're taught to see individuals, whether it's individual people or buildings or animals and things like that. In ecology, right, you're taught to think about systems. And so what are the, you know, even individual anomalies, right? Or individuals who are, what does that look like? What's the impact on the larger system, you know? And so I think that makes folks really, folks who have studied ecology or other kinds of systems, and I have to say economics people do this too, right? Your individual transactions, they do add up to something bigger, but it's not always the same, right? It's not a linear. And so, so doing biology in that way, thinking about rhythms, thinking about seasons, right? Like you get to see that things sort of, there are peaks and ebbs and flows, right? In water, in flowers and animals and the amount of food that's available in a forest. And that there's a lot of dynamics that you wouldn't necessarily, unless you had been there long enough, you wouldn't know to predict, right? And so that translates into my organizing work and my systems change work, because I think about, you know, if someone was like a jerk that day, it doesn't mean that they're a jerk all the time, right? So there's plenty of time to see what the pattern of behavior is, what that looks like, what emerges over time. And also like my really good friend, if they f up one day, it's not a big deal, right? Like there's that kind of things, but then on the larger scale, there's also like, we win some policy fights, we're gonna lose them, but if you see over time a particular trajectory, then there is a larger systems change effect happening, right? And that's exciting. So it doesn't have to be, yeah, I think it allows me to have a little bit more relaxation. Because you know what? You don't win all the time.
Right?
This contact who was great last year or 10 years ago may not be, maybe in a whole different thing in their lives right now, you know? And they might not be the right person to talk to, but that's okay. You just keep going. And the same with the conversations, the different pushes, and when you make asks, right? Mm-hmm. So that's also, I think, having the patience to see what's happening on a larger scale and not just, you know, each individual fight or each individual interaction.
I haven't heard anyone say that in a long time. That's refreshing. No. I feel like there's a lot of judgment, you know, like a lot of like rushing to conclusions about people and like what their capacity is and what that means, totally defining them in these snapshots in time, which is really onerous.
When I worked with Pastor Mark Knudsen at Augustana Lutheran Church on the anti-deportation campaign here for Francisco Aguirre, one of the big fights we had early on was to challenge this narrative that Francisco was a criminal, right? He'd been convicted, he'd done some jail time. And Pastor Mark was really, really insistent on people getting second chances, that people get to be brought along and that they are loved and part of, you know, God's creation or the sacred creation, regardless of what they do and have done, right? And so even when someone is like wrong or when someone has done something less than perfect, which, right, they still get to be human and they still get to be loved and they still get to be held with compassion, you know? It's not always easy. And then I think the other thing, you're shaking your head. The other thing that Pastor Mark said real clearly was like, I don't want to be judged by the actions that I did when I was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. You know,
totally.
I'm a different person now and definitely not, you know, my teens to early 20s. Like, I did some all funny kind of things then because I was a kid.
Yeah.
I was just learning who I was, you know. And I think Pastor Mark said that, and that was really incredible for me. So, you know, you saw me at this People of Color meditation retreat, and I think that's one of the things that, however it comes to people, right? Some people, I have a friend who's atheist who gets really, who would be really upset if I was like, oh, that's a spiritual, you know, connection or, but I would say, like, however you're connected to the larger world, right? Like, if you however you believe that, a lot of people find that connection in nature. But I do think that that's really, it's been really powerful for me to meet people who are actually intentionally, you know, faith-based and spiritually-based, whether that's Buddhist or, turns out I didn't know this, but there's a lot of radically progressive Christian and, you know, Catholic, Protestant, everything else, Muslim, Jewish faith leaders in the world, but also here in Portland.
Yeah.
And they're pretty awesome.
I want to jump backwards real quick in time and address your trajectory into labor and maybe go way back real quick just so people can get oriented and understand a little bit more fundamentally like who you are and how you got to be doing this work. So why labor? And clearly, I think people have been able to glean so far that your politics are like pretty on the radical side, which is great because so are some of ours at Pacific Underground, even though we're not super militant or heavy-handed, at least. But yeah, you had a very early start organizing and doing some activist work. I kind of want to go to a different snapshot. 1999.
Oh my god!
Seattle?
Yeah.
You're in a superhero costume?
Oh my god, wait, did I tell you this?
No, I did a little research.
I'm like, did I tell you this? It was fun. I went with a bunch of friends. You know, we were, I had never been in a mass mobilization before. I'd been in lots of, this is funny, I was in a marching band in middle school, right? So, I'd been in parades.
Uh-huh.
And then, so, like, same thing, you're in the streets, lots of people, right? What's different is the reason why you're in the street. But, you know, I think marching, like if you're in a marching band, you know actually how to march and be aware of the other people around you, right? That's
right.
Actually a really smart thing to do. And I wish more of our marches had a little bit more people with spatial awareness. Because I think we could do fun things,
yeah.
You know, in those things, especially when it's just a march. But Seattle was a turning point in me because, you know, growing up Asian American in the places where I had grown up, I had not personally experienced police violence until that point, or state-based violence through the police at that point. And so here's this thing that I thought, oh, this was celebrated, you know, in my high school texts about, you know, people being in the street and all the hippies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, oh, this is just part of what being American is, right? And so to have like pepper spray and tear gas and the horses running down the street for doing something that I thought was actually very American was actually a shift in my consciousness, right? One of many to come, but it was good. It was a good time and I really appreciated what I learned there. I also, you know, there's like this big sort of safer space, you know, the big arena and things like that. And at one point, you know, significant people, like 10,000 people from labor, came over because they heard that young people were being tear gassed in the streets of Seattle, in downtown Seattle, right?
10,000.
10,000.
Wow.
Labor people, steelworkers, ILWU, a whole bunch of other people. I don't even, you know, I wasn't that, I didn't know all the names.
Mm-hmm.
Made a huge difference in my consciousness of who is labor, right? And what's the possibility of these kinds of connections? Yeah, because, you know, the environmentalists were out there, the forest defense people, indigenous rights people.
Wow. So what inspired the superhero costume? And what superhero
was it? We were the
Hall
of Justice. I mean, we were young. I loved it. It was great. It was creative. We had fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were part of holding a blockade around the convention center.
Was that where the meetings were being held?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, they had the fence and they were trying to bus people in, and then people were surrounding the fence. And so people were successfully able to prevent the talks from being held. You know, there was a lot of inside outside negotiation, but I think that it was actually a very successful action. And it wasn't just that year, you know, it was all of the years following it until Hong Kong, where again they were unable to come to an agreement. So Hong Kong was like 5 or 7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
They were unable to come to an agreement in Hong Kong, and the next year the WTO dissolved. So the fact that folks sort of stayed on it for, I think that would have been like 7 or 8 years together before it sort of finally dissolved, that was really important and cool. Mm-hmm. The Hall of Justice, I think I was Aquaman. See, I was like gender bending even back then. I was like, you know.
Amazing. Yeah, can we go into like labor and organizing intersecting with queerness and gender?
Aww, that's so interesting.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Like what was that journey like, and when did that kind of start like folding itself into your identity and then subsequently your work?
Well, I read Gloria Anzaldúa. And then my life was ever changed. And then, you know, so it was partially like seeing, with Gloria Anzaldúa, it was very much like seeing the way that she writes in English and Spanish and Spanglish was very much the same way that like me and other people like me who were first generation born in the U.S., Chinese immigrants, but also, you know, I was hanging out with Chinese folks and Korean folks and other East Asians mostly, at that time, like, was the same way that we spoke, you know, our languages mixed with English.
Hmm.
And so it's super familiar, and there's this sense of recognition, you know, in her all the way through, right? Both around gender identity and presentation, but also around, and also my relationship to like dominant ideas around femininity at the time, right? I was never that, you know, like never. it turns out I was doing capoeira for 8 years, but capoeira, you know, is this Afro-Brazilian martial arts and dance form.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what that allowed me to do was to like reclaim a feminine presentation while still being really strong and badass and, you know, could kick your ass. I really loved that. And so there was also a freedom, you know, in that generation of feminists around, they expanded the category of female and woman so wide that it allowed folks like me who came after them to just be ourselves and then eventually, I think, reject or be fluid within, you know, gender boxes. And so this is not the like politically correct analytical me, right? For me, my personal journey on that was like, I mean, seeing that example of who they were let me play with all these different kinds of gender expressions and gender identity, and also mix it up, right? Like, and be really strong and be really butch and mm-hmm. things like that. One of my good friends would say, like, at the time, she was like, well, we were like jock femmes, you know, like, right?
People are like, how could the two things be?
It makes total sense. What are you talking about? That's what we were. It's true. We were like, anyway.
That's incredible.
And so one of the ways that intersects with labor, there's a couple, but one of the ones that's most important to me is that LGBTQ folks, but especially queer and trans folks and queer and trans people of color, have the highest rates of under and unemployment of almost any group, right? And so it's just sort of economic instability, however you measure it, You know, when you look like at homelessness, to the extent, it's not always true, but to the extent that homelessness is related to economic security, queer kids and queer kids of color in particular are like 50% of the kids on the streets in general in any large city. And so if, you know, labor is, if talking about labor and talking about working people and talking about economic security, certainly one of the, not the most, right, but one of the greatest areas of need is certainly with queer and trans youth of color. It's not just to develop their skills and make sure that they have the supports and the debriefs and everything else they need to be able to, like, but also to change outside society enough that folks can have security at work, right? And so that that means, as someone who's now working in labor, there's absolutely this goal of like opening space, you know, in labor for us, right? Because there aren't that many folks of color, queer folks, et cetera, who are visibly, you know, in leadership. Everybody's like, oh, but there's this one person over here. You know, it's like, yes, they're there. That's right. That's great. And that's, you know, that's not a full, diverse, rich representation of any community. And it's also to change outside society, right? So, like, when we're talking about these minimum wage laws, when we're talking about any of these other things around wages and benefits and working conditions, that's actually really important to hold the line that there are good jobs out there, even if not everyone has access to them, right? And then we keep pulling folks in. So we expand the pool of good jobs, right, by raising the bottom line and fighting shop by shop. And we make sure that everybody's included in that, right? And that's the work within labor to really make sure that folks like us and the people where our communities are working are included, right? Sometimes that's low-wage jobs, sometimes that's like the nonprofit sector, you know, things like that. There's absolutely a need for organizing in the nonprofit sector. There's absolutely a need that people who are supposed to be working for social justice get treated with dignity and respect at work, right? Mm-hmm. That's not, it's often enough it happens that that's not the case. That I think, you know, it's funny because in construction, right, the people, a lot of times the guys are like, well, that's just how it is in construction, right? But then you meet the good contractors, and the good contractors are like, no, that's not how it is. If you want to be a supervisor, you have to go through this training, and this is what it means to be a manager. And so there's an intentionality, in fact, in construction, of all things, about how your supervisors are trained with the good contractors. It's not across the board. That you know, a lot of times in other fields there isn't that same level of intentionality. And then I would say, like, in the building trades, there's also a real interesting, like, opening. You know, there's they're actually really intentionally have passed laws, and so folks with low levels of formal education, folks with priors, right, other things that are considered usually bars to entry for jobs. In the building trades, that's less of an issue, right? There are other things that are issues and challenges about getting jobs and keeping jobs and things like that.
Right.
But that's an interesting place where actually the sector is leading in terms of social justice.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Hey,
because I don't think that industry, that sector, doesn't really come to mind first as like progressive or leading on any like social issues.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody would necessarily say that. People would say, oh, that's just a pragmatic, you know, decision, right, or whatever. But it is. It's both pragmatic and it's ideological.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That's cool. There are some people in my life right now that are queer people of color that are having a really hard time entering into getting, you know, back into, like, the labor force, whether that's, like, actual, like, physical labor or just, you know, getting any sort of job because it is so hard. Everyone is feeling particularly raw, it seems, right now. And a place like Portland is so laden with tension. You know, I think some people are like scared to even go out and just be out in the world because of trauma they've experienced, and they don't want to be encountering people who are going to be triggering them, you know, like even if they're just on the street, even if they're just trying to like run errands and stuff.
Yeah.
What would you say to people that are like struggling with that right now? I know it's not an easy question and it's very like case by case when you get down to it, but
it's hard. I mean, that's real, you know. So there's that. I think so that's the most important thing to say, right? Is like that kind of level of everyday harshness and rudeness and everything else is right there. It's right on the surface here in Portland in ways that in the state of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, you know, mm-hmm. that in some other places in the world is just not quite the same, right? There's also a thing that happens to us internally when in other parts of the country where there's more folks, right? We're not such an anomaly that, like, at least you can get some basic, you know, normal day-to-day human interaction mm-hmm. When you're out and about in the world. And it's kind of a relief, right? I can feel my skin relax when I go to places like Oakland or LA or even Arizona, right? Like Phoenix, I was in Phoenix recently, and it's like you can just feel your skin relax because people, they just see you as a human being, and there might be all kinds of other layers of things that are happening around gender and race and things like that. But there's also like you're not the first one of this kind of person that I've ever seen, right? So there's a reality that to that kind of experience here in Oregon, and here in Portland. You know, the survival skills that I've seen all of us use here. I go out in public a lot less. I usually have at least one other person with me if I can. Like I go to, I have my spots, right? I have my store, I have my one bar. It's not even perfect, but I like to go there because they kind of know me, right? Like I kind of know that even if they're weird, I'm not going to get decent service, right? Like,
right. Or stairs or something.
Yeah, I won't get any stairs because, you know, like, but at that point, like everybody's got tattoos, whatever. and then, you know, I know a lot of our survival skills here is like we hang out at people's houses, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of folks don't really go out that much, and that's sad, right? Because I love dancing, I love going out, but yeah, between the gender and the race and the and those things, it's just sometimes it's a little. And then also, you know, I'm in my 40s now, so like I'm just like, man, I'm good. I'll go out for half an hour, and I'm like, peace, bye, you know. So I just like don't have the same urges that I did when I was in my 20s and 30s. So those are the things that I know that we do, and I'm sure everyone else who's listening, you know, who's in that group of people, understands that and does it. And it's I don't know. There's a certain amount of also like. I think I try to focus my energy on folks that I think want to enter into a conversation together, right? And so, like, the random things that happen in the store, sometimes I'll be like, oh, that one really drove me crazy and whatever, and I go, and I used to go to martial arts, so I'd just go hit the punching bag, right? It was great. And now, you know, I go run it off or something like that, but I don't know. I think everyone figures out their own survival strategies. And the most important thing to say is, like, you're not imagining it, you're not overreacting, you're not being too sensitive, all of those things are real. You know, are you going to let it take your energy? Are you going to let it suck up your life force? You know, that's a case-by-case basis, depending on what are the things that you've experienced in the past. And then there is being upset, and then there's sort of, like, the PTSD triggering trauma. Right, like sometimes we use triggering in a. It can't help everything, you know, especially if you're having an acute episode. But the kinds of things that you can learn in meditation, or you know, we started talking about this meditation, martial arts. If you're physically able to do those things, or music or creativity, you know, there's a lot of different ways to be grounded and connected. Or art forms, right? Like material arts, graphic arts, etc. All of those things really help us both be connected to yourself and like more aware actually of what's happening internally. And with the meditation, it was like, you know, this morning I had like, well, what if this is a setup, right? And then my other part is like, well, that's an interesting thought, Dee. You should brush your teeth and get out the door, right? Like, and so like
this interview.
No. But right, but like because of other things that have happened in my life, where people are really actually doing those things, like, you know, is this going to be like a friendly or a not friendly environment, right? Like, right. Well, all of the things that often, at least I think for many of us, prevent us from getting out the door. Is this really intense triggering thing going to happen, or is this person who was really rude to me like yesterday when I went to the store, or when I went out into the world, or is that my work, right? Mm-hmm. are they going to be there, right? All of that is like can be really, really intense. But I think like being able to watch things and then sort of be like, oh, that's just in my head. This is based on real information, you know? Mm-hmm. Those are helpful. They're helpful tools. Yeah. They aren't always great in a super acute, you know, moment, but they can help modulate a lot of the other things.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Portland. Right now, we're speaking with organizer and activist Deepay Wu, former head of Jobs with Justice here in Portland.
If you want to catch prior episodes of ours, you can find us on SoundCloud by searching for Pacific Underground. We're also on social media, though mostly just Facebook, but you can try us on Twitter at PAC Underground. And if you want to get in touch with us to share thoughts, feedback, or fiery criticism, you can email us at pacificunderground@kbu.org. pacificunderground@kbu.org. That's our email. And that's what you should type into your computer. We'll get back to the interview right now.
Now.
Okay, right now.
No. Wait for it. Now.
At least that's my experience so far. I'm actually pretty new to that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think when it comes to trauma and PTSD and CPTSD, mm-hmm. we're all still learning.
Yeah.
And learning how to negotiate that. And, like, that's a ride.
Yeah.
You just have to bear out.
Yeah.
And learn how to cope with.
Yeah.
And no one can make you feel better.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's hard.
And we're not alone. I mean, that's a right. good part, right? Like you, that there are friends in the five fingers of self-defense that the Destiny Arts Center teaches. They're based out of Oakland, but you know, I think this is true for adults as much it is for the youth that they do the trainings for. You know, they tell you to like use your head, assess the situation, use your eyes, use your ears, right? Find exits and solutions. Run if you have to. Run, right, is the first one, and then fight only if you have to. Right? Those are all really good principles for self-defense. But the last one is really important. The fifth finger of self-defense is to tell an adult that you trust. And I think as an adult human being in the world or someone, you know, who's older now, telling someone that you trust about what happened is actually still really important. Mm-hmm. It doesn't end with being a young person. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very real talk. Maybe we can jump back into the present and talk a little bit about Jay with Jay and what you're up to now.
Yeah.
So what is Jobs with Justice? It's a pretty big coalition, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like a group of people going and meeting up justice individually. It's a bunch of different organizations working in concert, and it's national, right?
Mm-hmm. So really interesting. Portland Jobs with Justice is turning 25, 26, 27, something like that. The National just had its 30th birthday. So Jobs with Justice chapters, there's almost 40, I think, all over the US. All of them have some pieces that are similar. And one of them is this idea of a labor community coalition that includes faith institutions and youth and student organizations. And I think, for the most part, is really pushing at this intersection of race and labor and gender, but especially race and labor, right? And so what that means is, you know, so in Portland, the chapter has over 120 organizational coalition members who agree to show up for each other, right? The central pledge is a solidarity pledge. And that is really a beautiful thing, right? You agree to show up at least five times a year for someone else's struggle and it's not even it's not enforced or enforceable, honestly, but the idea is that other people will show up for you, mm-hmm. right? It's definitely a good first step in terms of like movement building, is that people get to see each other and show up and support, even if I like don't understand, or maybe I don't 100% agree, right, with your strategy or your tactics or whatever. But there's I'm showing up, right? Because that's important. And showing up can be different. And I think this is a place where certainly those who just think about mobilizing and going out to rallies and things can really broaden you know, their analysis and their ability to be inclusive. Certainly disability rights activists are the kinds of folks who might talk about this, but this is also just good organizing. Think about ways that people can participate, whether they're participating from home, can they make a phone call, can they send something? What does escalation look like when you make the next ask of someone, taking into account different kinds of ability and disability, mm-hmm. you know? That's also important because, as we were talking about, folks with PTSD of any sort, like, yeah, some days I can't get out of the house, you know? But I want to be able to support. And so what is that kind of level of inclusion look like, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
Cool.
So that was Jobs with Justice. And so that was sort of the bread and butter. And then there's certain areas, different chapters, depending on, you know, which way they're going. Some of them are leading policy fights, you know, in places where there isn't another organization like Our Oregon or Fair Shot, you know, where there isn't similar kinds of coalition building. Jobs with Justice might be a table, you know, where those kinds of policy things could happen. There's also within labor some really exciting potential for racial justice work, right? If collective bargaining means that people have more power to determine the conditions of their work, then how cool is it when in your contract there are things that actually advance racial justice, right? That advance immigrant rights, that advance LGBTQ rights, you know? Or gender justice of any sort. So, like, really good healthcare and benefits, parental leave, trans-inclusive and trans-friendly healthcare and healthcare provision, all of those things are things that people could fight for in their contracts, in their bargaining. It's workplace by workplace, but it's pretty amazing, right? So to the extent that those kinds of moves can be implemented by a leader, you know, that's great. But more often than not, it takes some level of, like, work and organizing and agitation to make those kinds of wins happen. And that's, you know, that's the organizing at the workplace. But then those kinds of wins are often longer lived, mm-hmm. right? Because they have a broader support base than just a friendly leader.
Right.
So there's a real reason to do good stuff like that. So that was one of the things that I think is really at the leading edge of what labor can do to, you know, around racial justice and gender justice. One of the other things, of course, is getting more folks into labor and having people be able to be supported, right? On average, nationally, the difference between a state that's right to work and someone in a more heavily unionized state, it's like $10,000 of salary and $8,000 in benefits.
And for people who don't know what right to work is,
yeah, what? Right to work sort of it kind of gets in the weeds a little bit of the labor movement, but let's just say that, like, when it's that people get, supposedly from the rights messaging, it's that people get the choice to opt in or out of their union membership. From the place of organizing and labor, right? It's like, what that means is it cuts down on the power of organized labor, but also it allows a lot of people to get the benefits of what a few people have worked for, right? Without then, you know, paying back. So
it's kind of a misnomer.
Yeah, right, to be selfish. So you know, folks in labor hate it, and they call it, both because of the power involved as well as the resources, but also because it really doesn't build the kind of, I mean, you know, folks in labor, whether they like you or not, will call you brother or sister or cousin, right? They'll call you family. And that's interesting, right? And that's not what right to work is about at all, right? It really breaks up that idea that we take care of each other. How do we get there?
Right. And so what are you up to now?
Oh, I am so lucky. So I work for a labor organization, and I sort of, you know, don't really tell folks where I'm at, but I do alliance building between community organizations and working people, usually non-union folks who are looking for a fair shot. So usually they're trying to get better wages and benefits. And I get to help them by finding folks who can support them, you know, in labor, but also very much outside of labor. So our political representatives, community organizations, faith leaders and things like that. So real similar to what I was doing with Jobs with Justice, but I get to be sort of down in the nitty gritty of the campaigns. Nice. So that feels good.
Less like at the figurehead level where you're taking fire. And I guess one final question. Where do you see, I guess, in specific movements in Portland or maybe the Northwest or maybe nationally, do you see like the front lines of the labor movement and where the labor and racial justice movements intersect?
Well, I think there's some things, interesting things that labor is doing inside of itself, trying to be, you know, trying to do organizational culture shifts around being a better place to work and a better movement. I think that's really important, you know, whether, and that is both around like LGBTQ and especially the TQ part of inclusivity, as well as around racial justice and inclusivity. So that's one place where labor is doing, just becoming better internally so that they can meet the needs of their members. Right, so it's of all their members, because right now there's a lot of members who are being underserved, because if your steward's like a straight white guy, he may or may not understand some of the ways that, you know, microaggressions and trauma happen in the workplace, mm-hmm. and what those impacts are. So if he hasn't gone through the education to make himself aware of those things, then, you know, how can he be a great steward by going to these classes? And really then like learning the lessons there. So that's one piece of work that I know is happening across many, many labor organizations, and it's so great, right? Other ones are figuring out like, we're just not able to keep women in this particular field. Let's be better about that, right? It's actually important that we do these things. So that's really powerful for what's happening inside of labor. I think the other part is, where's the organizing, right? Where are new folks coming and being brought into the labor movement in a way where they can have good jobs but also careers, right? That there's a trajectory, you know, that people can look forward to, like to having like a good life and having some stability. That would be incredible. Yeah. Right. So I see some of those fights, and you know, Babatunde at Jobs with Justice is running a program with Black LGBTQ youth. It's so amazing that they're doing that work. Z both recruited these youth, you know, and then has found all of their trainers are folks of color week after week, and they have a project that they're working on. So all of that is just really powerful work. And then, you know, there's a couple places like Enlace is another organization, and Q Center is another organization, right? Like, so to the extent that some of our labor partners have started to build a tighter relationship with Q Center, that's really exciting to me. That's definitely a leading edge, right?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right? And then this other place where, like, these young people, right, are getting exposed to labor. They get to choose later on whether or not they want to walk down this road, but hopefully that initial exposure and the relationships that are built there mean that they are interested in pursuing, you know, a job in a represented sector, first of all, and then perhaps even in a union in the future, because that's important for all of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges I see is that people view labor as like very lacking in sex appeal. You know, it's like not the sexiest thing to go into.
Well, kind of sort of like being a little bit bush sometimes. So for me, it's like super sexy. What are you talking about?
Exactly. Yeah. Conventionally, I should say, in quotation
no,
marks.
No, I'm teasing. I mean, here's the deal. You know, like the other part is because of the work of all the people who came before us for the last several hundred years. Labor jobs are good jobs.
Yeah.
Represented jobs, not all of them, but most of them are much better than that job in the same sector where it's non-union.
Yeah.
So like a baker, right? A non-union baker shop here in town, people get paid, I think, $12, $15 minimum wage for the work that they're doing. This is a high level like industrial manufacturing bakering, so like really big machines, really dangerous, people lose limbs and parts of their bodies all the time. One of the highest, you know, safety and health hazard industries, along with construction. Police are like number, I don't know, way the hell down the list. I'm just saying. But like people in ironwork, people in construction, people in manufacturing, bakeries of all, you wouldn't think that, you know, your little fluffy bread comes at the cost of someone's finger, right?
Right.
But you make twice that in a union shop. You're making $25-$28 in a union bakery. Wow. Right?
Yeah.
On average, in my field, in construction, folks can be making $20-$30 more in a represented job than a non-represented job. And then even in the nonprofit sector, I know people who got $10,000 bumps when they unionized their workplace.
Wow.
Right? And so that, and it's not just your wages, it's all the benefits that come with it. It's like having great health care,
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, crappy health care or unaffordable health care. You know, it's called disaster care or whatever, hazard. Yeah. So like, it doesn't seem to be as important sometimes when you're younger, but then like, it's really important for folks who are considering any kind of trans stuff, right? Like for, or becoming a parent, or if you have any like health issues, surgeries, or accidents, even being able to say like, oh, I'm going to report this, and it doesn't, and it's okay, because even if my premium goes up, I can afford it. You know, those are really important things that happen to folks, and I've seen a lot of us survive by cutting corners. We've had to, but if you didn't have to. That's the power of having a union job. That's the power of having, you know, an organized job.
Cool. We're going to have to leave it somewhere, so we might as well leave it here.
All right.
I've been speaking with Dee Pei Wu, former executive director of Jobs with Justice, the Portland chapter. Dee, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much. It's been really nice. Thanks.
All right, that's going to do it for our show this week. You've been listening to Pacific Underground. I'm your host, Kanan. This is my co-host,
Jenna. Big special thank you to our guest, Dee Pei Wu, this week. Make sure to tune in next week, where we'll be talking to another activist to find out more about what is sustainable activism, what is organizing, especially here in Portland.
Did we make up the term sustainable activism? Maybe. Is it something that you thought about before you heard us say it? Maybe not.
Or maybe
you did.
Or maybe I stole that term from somebody else and I just remember who I stole it from. Actually, I've never heard anyone else say it.
I haven't heard anyone else say it.
Okay, so we need to keep pushing this term. So make sure that you go onto the socials and you hashtag sustainable activism.
You don't have to take the blame for it.
No, you're not making it up. KBOO made it up. So if you want to blame somebody, blame KBOO. There you go.
Hashtag.
Blame KBOO.
And we're going to have a show next week. On Friday, a week from today, but at 9 a.m. And we're going to do a live show where we're hopefully going to be sitting down with another activist, a local activist. And it's going to be a riveting conversation. It's definitely not one you're going to want to miss. Thank you to KBOO for the studio space, love, and support. And thank you to Derek Crooks, the AM News and Public Affairs Director. And special thanks, of course, to Dee Pei Wu for letting us sit down and talk with him this week. We'll catch you all next time.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:57 a.m. And coming up soon, after some important commercial and, I'm sorry, community announcements. And maybe a bit of placeholder sounds. We're going to bring you moving on with a special guest host, Ed Melnick. And a special Forests of Fenario edition of the Song Circle featuring Phil G, followed by the Roots of Rock and Roll. So much great music filling out your Friday afternoon, leading you up to the evening news and public affairs block, in turn leading you to an entire weekend of the best music you will ever hear anywhere, ever. Isn't that worth supporting? A lot of your friends and neighbors already have, and you can too at kboo.fm/give. And for now, let's hear about what's happening in your community via your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. The Willamette River Festival is a celebration on the waterfront with live music by Shanghaied on the Willamette, Norman Sylvester, and more, as well as a beer garden, food carts, an environmental fair, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and more. Again, that's the Willamette River Festival and Movie in the Park, Sunday, July 30th from 1 to 10 p.m. at the Cathedral Park waterfront in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
And this is Moving On